Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. Okay, last week we started talking about Outside's People of the Year, and we're going to continue that. And our next person, or group actually, is Anila Hillman and Shook Shook Hillman and Molly Myers, as well as many other members of the Karuk, Hoopa, Klamath, Shasta, and Yurok tribes, who helped lead the largest dam removal project in U.S. history. By Jeff Moag. Molly Myers was pregnant with her firstborn when the salmon began to die. It was 2002, during the depths of a year-long drought, and farmers upstream of her community on the Yurok Reservation in Northern California had pressured the George W. Bush administration to divert water from the Klamath River in Oregon to irrigate their fields. Water temperatures rose as the river slowed through the summer, and in September, Chinook salmon returning to spawn began to die, littering the banks with as many as 70,000 carcasses. 2 years later, with her young son in her lap, Myers testified in Orleans, California, before a panel of Federal Energy Regulatory Commission officials charged with renewing the operating license of four hydroelectric dams that contributed to the fish kill. None of the panelists looked her in the eye as she described the structure as an existential threat to the river and the salmon that have sustained her Karuk people since time immemorial. When the meeting ended, Myers joined a handful of Native people and friends around a bonfire by the river in Orleans to lick their wounds and vent their anger. "That was when we made the decision to dedicate ourselves to dam removal," Myers recalled, "and that has been our lives." The Klamath River flows 263 miles from southern Oregon to far northern California through ancestral lands of the Klamath, Karuk, Hoopa, Shasta, and Yurok, whose traditions and way of life grew around the river and the abundance it provided. The Klamath once teemed with salmon, but the dams built between 1918 and 1964, without consulting the tribes, blocked the fish from critical spawning habitat on the upper river and its tributaries. The dams provided no drinking water and almost no flood control. Toxic algae bloomed in the reservoirs, and they accounted for less than 2% of the electricity generated by their owner, PacifiCorp. Still, taking them down would involve the largest dam removal project in American history. The tribes would accept nothing less. They organized protests at PacifiCorp's Oregon headquarters, then traveled to Edinburgh, Scotland, to lobby the utility's parent company, Scottish Power, which proceeded to sell PacifiCorp in 2006. The new owner was Berkshire Hathaway Energy, controlled by Warren Buffett, then the planet's wealthiest man. The coalition shifted their protest to Omaha, Nebraska, where Berkshire Hathaway's annual shareholders meeting packs a 19,000-seat arena. In 2008, 23-year-old Karuk tribal member Shook Shook Hillman waited in line all night and sprinted for a microphone and the chance to question Buffett directly. As Hillman introduced himself in the Karuk language, a stunned hush fell over the crowd. Switching to English, he demanded Buffett sign an agreement to remove the dams as Georgiana Myers and Neil Hillman of the Yurok tribe unfurled a banner proclaiming Buffett's Klamath dams equals cultural genocide. "The world's richest man doesn't faze me at all, because in our culture, I'm just as equal as any other being on the planet," Shook Shook Hillman recalls. "I got my moment, and I took full advantage of it." After two other Klamath River defenders spoke up, Buffett announced that he wouldn't take any more questions about the dams, and security hustled the remaining activists out of the queue. The protesters had made their point and could now engage Buffett's people in a language they understood. The cost of adding fish ladders and bringing the dams up to spec for relicensing was more than it would cost to tear them down, and more than they'd never earn back. The smart play for PacifiCorp was to walk away. Over the next 16 years, without easing the threat of direct action, the tribes worked with environmentalists, irrigators, commercial fishers, state and federal governments, and PacifiCorp itself to help the utility company to do just that. In 2010, nearly 50 parties signed a dam removal settlement and environmental restoration agreement, only to watch them both die in Congress 5 years later. The tribes then took the lead in new talks, negotiating an amended agreement that didn't require congressional approval. The Corps formed the nonprofit Klamath River Renewal Corporation to manage the project, with the state of California contributing $250 million in dam removal and remediation costs, and PacifiCorp ratepayers covering the remaining $200 million. Last major hurdle was approval by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the agency Molly Myers had testified to decades ago. In November 2022, as officials met in Washington, D.C., Myers joined friends by the river in New Orleans, gathering around a Starlink connection to share the historic moment with their children, now grown, who'd witnessed the dam removal fight their entire lives, and elders who thought they would never live to see it succeed. "We built the bonfire," she says. "We pulled out all of our old banners from over the years, and we celebrated." Dam removal began the following spring and continued in earnest this year. The largest of the four structures, Iron Gate, stood 173 feet tall and 740 feet long. In May, excavators began reducing the earthen formation scoop by scoop, lowering the soil into oversized trucks that would return it to the pit it was taken from decades ago. The same day, crews of young people walked the steep embankments, spreading native seeds as part of a habitat restoration effort that would go on for years. By August, all four dams were gone, freeing the river to carry on the work of healing itself and providing migrating salmon a clear route upstream for the first time in more than a century. Next up is Paige McClanahan, the author of one of the year's most compelling books on overtourism, lays out exactly how we can travel better by Tim Neville. Paige McClanahan, a journalist and travel writer, is much too diplomatic to phrase it this way, so allow me to be the grump. You're the reason locals so often dislike tourists. Travel has become a consumerist exercise where the goal is to get our money's worth out of a place, McClanahan says in a phone interview from her home in France. We need to wake up. Paris owes you nothing. The tourist-local tension has been around since before Marco Polo, but in her debut book, The New Tourist, Waking Up to the Power and Perils of Travel, McClanahan shows us just how bad things have gotten. Globally, travelers will log some 1.5 billion trips abroad by the end of 2024, the largest movement of people the planet has ever seen. In a handful of years, that number could reach 1.8 billion. Closer to home, Americans are on track to take almost 2 billion domestic leisure trips annually by 2025. Despite the buzz around mindful experiences and sustainable travel, locals from Athens to Zermatt have had enough of us. Some Hawaiians have requested that we stay home. Roman fined tourists up to $280 for clogging the Spanish steps. In July, an annoyed mob roamed Barcelona's boulevards, dousing visitors with squirt guns. McClanahan, who writes for the New York Times, Washington Post, and The Guardian, has plugged her journalistic pen into this bursting dike with empathy. Not by shaming or lecturing anyone, nor does she ask people to stay put, which would be detrimental to conservation work, prosperity, and cultural bridge building. Instead, McClanahan uses the voices of locals adversely affected by tourism to inspire us to travel with more curiosity, humility, and appreciation for how our holiday can be held on the climate and local residents. Above all, she wants us to know that we have the power to make travel a force for good. This elevated mindset is a hallmark of the new tourist. Becoming one isn't hard. It means visiting Iceland in the off-season or trading the line at the Louvre for a Paris-Norwalk tour to soak up the city's black history. You can control your partying in Amsterdam and stay behind the fence in the Grand Canyon. You can insist on supporting local guides in locally owned hotels, restaurants, and food carts. The Barcelona mob targeted people eating at a Taco Bell, among other spots. Even if you're a low-budget traveler, you can still be a high-value visitor, McClanahan says. McClanahan, who left the United States at age 26 and has spent the past 17 years riding from Africa and Europe, admits that she has made plenty of old tourist mistakes, like posting a self-serving Instagram reel from Angkor Wat that barely showed Angkor Wat. I live in a glass house, she says. McClanahan casts no aspersions on the types of trips you like, but does bristle at people who consider themselves travelers and not tourists. I don't deny that people travel for a huge range of reasons, some higher-minded than others, she writes in The New Tourist. So sure, call yourself a traveler, but never forget you're a tourist, too. What matters is that we make informed decisions on how to travel in ways that put places and the people who live there first. One of the most constructive things we can do in our flickering moments of life is to embrace the chance to leave our comfort zones, those dangerous lairs where we learn to languish, she writes. She adds to me, none of us can wave a magic wand and change the behavior of millions of other people, but each of us can be that change. Our next outsider of the year is Purnima Shrestha, the mountaineer who summited Mount Everest 3 times in 2 weeks, by Owen Clark. Born into a family of subsistence farmers in the tiny village Argat, Nepal, Purnima Shrestha thought that the mountains around her were out of reach. Her village is a stop on the Manaslu circuit en route to the eponymous 8,000-meter peak. But Shrestha's family didn't even have running water. As a woman, she was expected to marry young, raise children, and keep house. Shrestha decided early that this path wasn't for her. First, she broke from tradition by moving to Kathmandu at 16 to pursue her education. She stayed with relatives until she graduated from secondary school, then enrolled in college to study communications. Later, she landed on an internship with Hospitality Food and Wine, kickstarting a career in publishing. While covering the 2017 Everest Marathon, Shrestha became enthralled with the world's highest summit. To her, it represented a pinnacle of human achievement. In Nepal and around the world, everyone thinks of Everest when they think of mountains, she said. The 29,032-foot summit was an outside goal for the daughter of a poor farmers, but Shrestha took it one step at a time. In the beginning, I had nothing, she said. I had no experience, no money. I wasn't even athletic. I had no idea how strong my body was, but I wanted to try. So Shrestha took out some loans, started training, and committed herself to climbing. In the 7 years since, she has summited 8 of the world's 8,000-meter peaks. This year, the 34-year-old became the first woman in history to summit Everest 3 times in a single season, between May 12th and May 25th. Shrestha didn't set out to break records. Everest was just the highest, hardest goal she could imagine. I wanted to see what I was capable of, she said. After she summited once, she said, all of my dreams centered on climbing it again. I prayed for a reason to go back. With her newfound visibility, Shrestha feels an obligation to be a beacon for change. Through her work, she has witnessed the problems facing her country's mountaineering industry. Chief among them are the backbreaking labor Sherpa guides, porters, and other mountain workers undertake, along with the physical risk and scant benefits. You can only do this job as long as your body allows, Shrestha said. It's difficult and there's no security or insurance. This generation of mountain workers don't want the next generations to get into the industry. It's not sustainable. Shrestha says that she hopes the Nepalese government will consider providing insurance and other benefits, such as retirement funds for mountain workers. Success isn't guaranteed when it comes to the world's highest peaks, where avalanches, storms, and altitude can stymie the most capacious lungs and ironclad wills. But the important thing is to try, says Shethra, particularly as a female climber. People always make women feel weak, and we internalize this. We convince ourselves we can't do things that we will fail. I want to tell other women that there's nothing that limits us. And our next outsider of the year is Marley Blonsky. The co-founder of All Bodies on Bikes is changing the industry one ride at a time, by Alyssa Ages. Learning to ride a bike can be your first taste of freedom. Suddenly, the world beyond your front door opens up, ready to be explored on two wheels. But for Marley Blonsky, it wasn't that simple. Back when she was 8 years old, trying to ride with her older sister and her friends, she was told she was too slow. I always wanted to be part of the club, she says. It felt like something I was constantly striving for and not really accomplishing. As an adult, Blonsky, 38, faced similar barriers and some new ones she hadn't anticipated. She found that the weight limits on most road bikes were too low for her. Her rides were hampered by broken spokes and cracked saddle rails. Most cycling apparel brands had limited sizing, so she struggled to find comfortable jerseys and bibs. On group rides, she felt that familiar sensation of being left behind. So she did something about it. In 2021, along with Kaylee Kornhauser, Blonsky founded All Bodies on Bikes, a club that welcomes riders regardless of their size, gender, race, or ability. Over the past 3 years, the group has expanded to 10 chapters, with plans to add nearly 30 more by 2027. Each chapter is encouraged to organize rides, collaborate with other bike advocacy organizations in its area, and host events like gear swaps and fix-a-flat clinics. We don't care why you're riding a bike, she says. We just want to empower you to do it joyfully. In 2024, All Bodies on Bikes led several bike camping trips. The one hosted by the Kansas City chapter had 50 riders and co-hosted the biggest finish line party in gravel cycling, the DFL party for dead fucking last, at Mid-South Gravel. Looking forward, the organization's strategic plan includes establishing industry standards for weight limits on bikes and components, pushing brands to represent a greater range of sizes in their advertising, and creating a retail certification for bike shops to let would-be clients know that this shop is knowledgeable in working with customers of size and will treat you with dignity and respect, Blonsky says. By creating a cycling community that embraces people of all shapes and sizes, Blonsky has made what can be intimidating sport more approachable for new riders. She regularly receives messages from people about how meaningful it is to see a diversity of bodies represented in cycling. After years of feeling excluded, the self-identified fat cyclist has found power in throwing open the gates. It doesn't feel like what we're doing is that radical, she says, to slow down a little bit, to see folks and meet them where they're at. Shouldn't be that incredible of a thing, but it is. And that was an article on Marley Blonsky. And next up we have Angelo Baca, Kitty Calhoun, Sahar Khadijourney, and Norman Lemelon. Changemakers who are powering and empowering a native community with solar generators, by Jen Murphy. For decades, American alpinist Kitty Calhoun made a name topping out on some of the world's highest peaks, including the West Pillar of 27,766-foot Makalu in the Himalayas. But what stayed with her more than any summit view were the alarming effects of climate change. At such elevations, she often noticed the melting ice, a hindrance to her ascent, but in the high deserts of Utah, the repercussions were causing real daily struggles for those living on the Navajo Nation, something she became aware of while mentoring an indigenous climber who'd grown up there. For over a century, natural resources like oil, coal, and uranium extracted from Navajo land have powered the American West. Approximately one-third of the Navajo Nation, roughly 13,500 families, live without power. That indignity on its own is hard to fathom, but climate change has also exacerbated the aridity and seasonal heat in this region, forcing families to endure more triple-digit days without respite. With that in mind, last year, Calhoun persuaded Utah-based Lion Energy to donate 35 solar-powered kits, lunchbox-sized generators that can be charged in as little as 4 hours, and raise $32,500 to buy an additional 65 for families in one of the reservation's most disadvantaged areas, remote Navajo Mountain. Equipped with 100-watt solar panels, a single kit can run a mini-fridge for 16 hours, charge a laptop 11 times over, and last up to 20 years. Calhoun then reached out to Norman Lehman, the native founder of C4 Evergreen, a nonprofit devoted to preserving tribal values, to lead the distribution efforts. I didn't want to force kits on people, Calhoun says. If they were interested, Norman could explain how the technology worked in their language. Angelo Baca, a Navajo Hopi distance runner and filmmaker, and Sahar Khadijourney, a Navajo Persian producer and director, documented the project using a grant Calhoun received from Protect Our Winters for a film called Navajo Solar Sunrise. It's important for us to take care of people from indigenous land perspective. from indigenous perspective. The people are part of the land, Baca says. It's important to step away from extractive resources. Our people are still dealing with the effects of uranium contamination on the reservation. And solar isn't the end-all solution, but it's an important first step. In October of 2023, the trio traveled with Lyman to oversee installation and document the myriad ways that kits can improve lives. Families were able to run fans when temperatures soared and refrigerate food, medication, and breast milk. They could rely on electric blankets and small space heaters to keep them warm in the winter and access the internet to apply for jobs, government programs, and educational opportunities. They could charge their phones. Before the kits, Calhoun says many residents relied on car batteries to power such necessities. Living simple should not mean living in poverty, she says. Our final outsider of the year is Shailene Woodley, who wants you to touch grass. The actor environmentalist knows that nature is never far from reach. This is by Melissa Johnson. The camp chairs are set up. A cracked clipboard rests under my arm. I'm stuffed into my mom jeans. It's showtime. June gloom, blankets, and Sonino Canyon in lush mist. I could be in Narnia instead of Malibu, but I barely notice. My body stands in front of a marooned airstream waiting, but my mind is back home wondering if my 14-month-old is napping as I review the research on my clipboard. Tonight, I'll camp in this patch of Eden with Shailene Woodley, the 33-year-old actor environmentalist known for her lead roles in The Fault in Our Stars, the Divergent trilogy, and the series Big Little Lies, instead of sleeping at home with my daughter, the first time I've been away from her overnight. There she is, a member of our six-woman crew says. An electric sedan with a mint-green surfboard on top crunches to a stop. A luminous creature in a pastel silk shirt emerges and wraps me in a hug. My mind freezes. My clipboard is blank on a basic human greetings. I had to stop at REI and get a new sleeping pad, Woodley says, rolling her eyes. I left my old one with my ex. The actress is no stranger to camping and remarkably at home in the outdoors. From a young age, she's felt the kinship with and responsibility towards the natural world. Her lifelong commitment to environmental work started when, as a freshman at Simi Valley High School, she rallied her fellow students to petition for a recycling program. Since then, she's become an outspoken advocate for climate, working with various nonprofits, NGOs, and participating in the Standing Rock protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline. We sit under ancient oak trees in collapsible chairs. If Woodley has a phone, I don't see it. When I ask about it, she says, I guess I'm addicted to real interaction. She glimpses mine and coos at the wallpaper photo of my baby. When I tell her I met the love of my life at 39, she says, you give me hope. Woodley radiates something I can't place. Youth and beauty? Sure. But that's everywhere in Hollywood. Later, when I play back the recording of our conversation, I hear how rushed I sound, so determined to ask all the questions to get somewhere. But she's in no hurry. She's right here. When my editor asked me to profile Woodley as an outsider of the year, he said we could range to meet her anywhere. I fantasized about Patagonia or Fiji, but said Woodley chose Leo Carrillo State Park in western Malibu, where she grew up camping. She was born some 70 miles east of here in Upland, and her family camped constantly at nearby state beaches, starting when she was just a few months old. Her father refurbished a disgusting RV he found in the desert for that purpose. I can still smell it, she says. Easters and Thanksgivings were spent at Leo Carrillo and Big Sycamore State Parks. Easter eggs are probably still hidden in the trees, she muses. Unfortunately, all the permits were scooped up months ago, but we found an idyllic piece of undeveloped private land nearby. The owner occasionally hosts weddings up in a meadow with an ocean view. We're nestled near a creek line with verdant foliage and graceful sycamore. There's this idea of nature that we have to leave and go someplace to find it, Woodley says. It's everywhere. I look at flower if I'm baking, I'm like, you came from Earth. God, you're so cool. One of the people who modeled this attention to small details for her was Woodley's grandmother, a naturopath. In 2015 Elle interview, Woodley said that her grandmother was a bedrock of support and wisdom. She'd tell the young star, you must live from your deep heart. I recite this line back to Woodley and explain how at the time I read them, those words helped me navigate away from a relationship and a job that were sapping my spirit. Oh my God, I love that, Woodley says, tearing up. Yes, she said that all the time. I bring up another interview, this one with Shape magazine, where she talks about her relationship with the sea and describes feeling the ocean's suffering as if it were her own. I'm all water. She waves her hand, Scorpio sun, Pisces moon, Cancer rising. I can't talk about anything without crying. When I later speak with one of Woodley's longtime friends, the actor and model Cara Delevingne, she explains that she didn't believe people like Woodley existed before they met. Not in Hollywood, not anywhere. She is her heart. It's not that she wears it on her sleeves. She's just heart. These instincts and this porous way of being in the world have powered Woodley's acting career since she was five. First lead role in a TV series came with ABC Family's A Secret Life of the American Teenager in 2008. 3 years later, she stole scenes from George Clooney in Alexander Payne's The Descendants. When Hollywood success came her way in 2014, playing a teen cancer patient in The Fault in Our Stars and the hero of the Divergent sci-fi trilogy, she went small. She stored a few belongings in the mom's garage, gave up everything else she owned that wouldn't fit in a carry-on, slept on friends' couches, and explored the far reaches of the globe when she wasn't working. She describes this chapter of her life as an experiment in how to inhabit the world with intention and minimal impact. Sleep in the same place you shit, basically, she says with a smile. She was a happy vagabond without a home for 10 years. One of those couches belonged to Laura Dern, who bonded with Woodley while playing her mother in The Fault in Our Stars. Dern talks about waking up in L.A. one day to find Woodley in the kitchen making almond milk and hatching a plan to take Dern's two preteens to MTV's Video Music Awards at night as her dates. When asked Woodley's relationship with the wild, Dern says, "We keep grasping at how to be more connected to nature through our lives. Most of us. Charlene's is nature. It's one thing," Dern says, "to run the standard celebrity playbook, raising money and doing media appearances for environmental causes. It's another to put your body into the fight." In 2016, Woodley was arrested along with 26 other protesters at the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock. She was jailed, strip searched, and given a year's probation. In a piece she later wrote for Time, she urged people to shift their attention away from her. The hashtag Free Charlene had gone viral, and she implored readers to consider the impact that a slogan like hashtag Protect Clean Water or hashtag Honor Native Treaties might have had, had it received the same attention. Back under the oak tree, my voice speeds up as I get into environmental work. I'm eager to show off my research. Did she want to talk about her caravan for Bernie Sanders in 2016? How about her 2019 expedition to the Sargasso Sea to learn about the impacts of plastic? Or supporting a call to the United Nations in 2022 for a treaty to protect ocean life beyond national jurisdictions? Woodley politely absorbs my regurgitation of her resume. I stumble onto the Now section on the clipboard, and she reanimates when I mention Hope in the Water, a 2024 PBS documentary project about sustainably sourced seafood. The three-part series was conceived by David E. Kelly, the writer and producer who cast Woodley in the 2017 HBO series Big Little Lies. In Hope in the Water, Woodley is one of four celebrity hosts. In her episode, she learns about zombie sea urchins that are destroying kelp forests along the California coast. During an ocean outing, she surprised members of Kelly's crew. He got a call. "She's jumping in the water," a crew member says. "That's her," Kelly recalls. "She's going to dive in." Sitting across from me now, Woodley opens up about her work with Conservation International, whose board she sits on. The nonprofit works broadly across sectors, funding research and innovation to support biodiversity, sustainable agriculture, and more. The way she sums up their mission is, "Nature heals nature. We just need to get out of the way." Of course, it takes a lot of work to get out of the way. CI operates in 29 countries with more than 2,000 partners. M. Sanjayan, the group CEO, likes to put Woodley in front of corporate leaders. "She can speak truth to power," he says. She points out what we will all lose in no uncertain terms. And then she points out how the companies could be doing more. Woodley agrees that corporate coalitions play a vital role in fundamental change, and that's worth doing the outreach work to actually make things happen. "I want to be part of the rebuild of this planet," she says. For Woodley, caring for the earth and caring for people come from the same place. "We're apathetic towards the experience of nature because we're apathetic towards the experience of one another," she says. But I tell her she strikes me as an incredibly empathic person. Her face falls to a fault, she says. She's recently emerged from her own rebuild. "Had a really awful traumatic thing happen in early 2022, she says. She's not specific, but I know that her engagement to NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers was called off that February. I felt like I lost my soul, myself, my happiness, my joy, she says. I really understood depression, anxiety, and like complete soul detachment." She takes a breath. She chose to remain in a toxic situation, she says, because she was empathizing with someone else. Empathy, she says, kind of kept me in this loop of feeling everything for everyone. Woodley credits her best friend's stylist, Chris Zero, who scheduled a style to shoot this afternoon, with saving her life. "I knew I was depressed when I looked at a tree and felt nothing," she says. "That was the lowest of low of my life." In the aftermath, Zero woke Woodley up every morning, blasting music to get her out of bed. "Sometimes I was so angry at her," Woodley says, "but then we go surf, and for 10 minutes that day, I thought life could be okay again. Then the depression would come back, and she'd go, 'We're volunteering at the horse ranch,' and we'd find a random fucking horse ranch, and we'd clean up horse shit. We'd clean hooves and brush the horses, and for 20 minutes that day, I thought life could be okay again. And then the depression came back, and she'd wake me up the next morning and go, 'Let's go on a hike and bring trash bags and clean up trash.' After about 6 months of this, the depression started to fade. Earlier in our conversation," she said, "I haven't shared much about my relationship with Aaron because it," her eyes well up, "always makes me cry. It was not right, but it was beautiful." A second EV with a surfboard on top curls down a steep path and stops next to our oak tree, music blaring. The raven-haired driver is chic in the effortless way of California surfer girls. It's Zero. The friends holler back and forth. Zero hands us green teas from Starbucks. Golden light glints off the Airstream. It's the magic hour. Time for the photo shoot. I follow Woodley downhill and turn off the recorder on my phone. She tells me I should have brought my baby along. Her voice is so soft that I almost miss her final remark. "One of my biggest dreams is to be a mom." Woodley climbs up into a sycamore as Carolyn Tompkins, our tattooed photographer from Brooklyn, snaps away. Zero serves as DJ, blasting music with her car, windows down, with her hands low on a large branch. Photo shoots can be notoriously hierarchical, but Woodley sets the tone. She wants everyone to have a good time. The westering sun glows over faces and hair, and I can't help but notice how beautiful everyone looks. By the time we're sitting on a bumper taking a selfie while we flash our bras, this assignment has become a girls' trip. I've lost my clipboard. We'd planned to go back to the campsite, cook over Coleman's, but we're cold and hungry now and opt instead for the back table of an empty cafe. Almost everyone orders the green soup Woodley swears is the best. The youngest member of our party and a production assistant who's an aspiring comedian sits across from me. PAs are the grunts. The invisible servants and celebrities don't usually talk to them on set unless it's to order coffee. But I hear Woodley ask her, "What's your type?" Because maybe she knows somebody to fix her up with on a date? I'm sure this is just polite talk. Irrepressible and quick, the PA tosses her blonde bob theatrically and declares, "Well, I like to be the pretty one. My face hurts from laughing." Zero offers us a ride to camp, and without a word, Woodley gets in back, letting my 6-foot-4 frame ride shotgun. Midnight fog rolls so thick through the canyon, I could carve out 2 scoops and eat it like ice cream. I'm inside a cloud or a lake. A chorus of male frogs bellows from the stream next to me, an opera about love and lost insects, about living between water and land and not belonging fully to either. Maybe I should have skipped that second cocktail. I hear footsteps, not close, but not far. "I love life," the voice says. "Not to me, not to anyone. It's Woodley." I'm tempted to say that I feel younger than I have in a long time, but that's not it. What we long for and miss about youth isn't the smooth skin and lack of a mortgage. It's the experience of presence, of time changing shape. I sense it slow and swell around me like water finding its way down a mountain, polishing every pebble along the way. The goal isn't to feel young again, it's to feel this present, this odd, this saturated with life. I fall asleep with frogs echoing in my head. After a morning of lounging and enjoying the beach, we say our goodbyes on the side of the Pacific Coast Highway. I notice Woodley typing into the PA's phone. She's sharing her number because she does, in fact, want to fix her up on a date. My body knows it's time to go. I'm exhausted and need caffeine, but can't quite get in the car yet. I hoist Woodley's surfboard over the top of her car, and she attaches it to the rack. My eyes squint against the hard white sky. Then she casts off from the pulsing current of the Pacific Coast Highway, her car shimmering like a fish, recognizable for a moment, and then gone. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.